From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When you first heard about a horde of protesters storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, who did you believe was responsible? Has the responsible party changed in your mind since you first heard the news? How often do you read a headline that pops up in your social media feed, feel a flash of anger, and share it right away? And you still only read the headline. Is it possible that you've passed along fake news by reacting to that flash of anger? That's one of the key ways, according to studies, that misinformation spreads. Today, propaganda, conspiracy theories, and outright falsehoods are not only widely available through media platforms masquerading as news, they are gaining an alarming degree of traction in American hearts and minds, since they're often presented as news that the mainstream media refuses to report. Believers of these false stories view the very organizations charged with keeping the interests of the public in the forefront instead as conspirators in a sinister cover-up. According to a recent MIT study reported on by The Atlantic, fake news consistently reaches a larger audience than factual news stories. Today, partly in honor of National News Literacy Week and partly because of the prevalence of false narratives that we've heard recently by local folks around the events of January 6th, we're going to take a closer look at the dynamic and ways that we can all become better news consumers. Joining me now, Jennifer Brubaker, PhD. She is an associate professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she specializes in the intersection of media and politics. In November, her first book, Celebrity and the American Political Process, came out through Lexington Books. Professor Brubaker, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you for having me.
A pretty solid body of research shows us that the more time people spend on social media, the more depressed and the more dissatisfied they tend to feel. But other than feeling bad about your own life and nothing being maybe Instagram worthy, what is the actual harm of being on social media and engaging with fake news? What does fake news do in our society?
People have a tendency on social media. I mean, people have the tendency in real life, first of all, and then it transfers onto social media to gather together with like-minded individuals. I mean, it comes out of basic psychological theory on selectively exposing yourself to points of view that reinforce your attitudes and your beliefs, because they make you feel better about how you feel. If you start to see things that are misaligned with your attitudes and your beliefs, it makes you uncomfortable. If you hear perspectives that are out of line with your beliefs and your attitudes, it makes you feel uncomfortable. And we don't like that feeling of discomfort. And so in order to prevent against that, we start to seek out media organizations that reinforce our attitudes. We start to seek out people who reinforce our attitudes. And so we tend to group together in with this similarity and this idea of similarity. Now, in real life, we do that on an interpersonal, just if you look around at your friends, you know, the people we tend to associate with, they tend to be like-minded individuals. But when it transfers onto social media, it becomes very, very easy to do that. And in the last few years, you know, Facebook has kind of had a push to this more group mentality and forming these groups as opposed to, you know, to prior formats of it. And so these groups now, you tend to, again, gather with like-minded individuals. And it may be people who like the same sports teams that you do, or the same, you know, TV shows that you do, or like to knit or exercise or whatever it is, but it's all gathering around these like-minded. And when that translates into political viewpoints, now it's very easy to set up a, you know, a network of individuals who are not going to disagree with you. And it shuts down any type of dialogue that might be constructive out there, because now it's simply people who think the same way that you do reinforcing your opinion. And so when you talk about fake news and the spreading of fake news, it's a lot easier to spread that misinformation when you're already sending it out to people who are likely to agree with you. And so they're likely to respond in a positive way. And when you're spreading something out there to these people who are along the same lines as you, most people are not necessarily thinking, oh, I need to check this. Is this factually correct? Is this accurate? Is this coming from a credible source? It's more thinking, are my friends going to like this? Am I going to get a bunch of likes? Am I going to get a retweet? What am I going to get from this that's going to validate how I feel and who I am, as opposed to, I need to see if this is actually something that's true.
Now, how has the news media landscape changed since you first started studying the intersection of media and politics in the early aughts?
Well, my very first studies in media and politics were in 2000. So it has changed dramatically in that time period. There's definitely been a tendency for a very partisan split that wasn't there. I mean, you know, the role of social media and the bringing in of the internet and the proliferation of media sources that are out there, you know, you would think if we would have been asked what's going to happen in, you know, the late 90s, oh, what if we had all of this information at our disposal? You would think that we're going to be such an informed society. We're going to know so much. But the reality is all of this information that's out there, it's coming from so many different places that we just don't have the brain space or the time to siphon through all of it. So we tend to use shortcuts to pick the things that we like or agree with. And so we tend to become very uninformed. So, and also we become very split, because now we're just seeking the things that are on our side. And, you know, the other side is seeking the things that are on their side. And so this partisan divide has been caused by, you know, partially by this media change that we've seen in the last 20 years.
And I definitely want to get more into the partisan divide in terms of news sources. But you also have a really interesting perspective, because you used to work as a media relations person or communications person for an elected official in Ohio. And you struggled with the main news organization there at the time. What kind of perspective do you have now as a result of that, being both a journalist and a public information officer of sorts?
Well, it's very, that was a very long time ago. And it's very interesting to see, though, that each side has their goals, and they have, both sides have an agenda. And agenda isn't a bad thing. They just both have, this is what we hope to accomplish. This is what we need to accomplish. And so when those things are together, that's great. But when they're at odds, each side is going to have to kind of look out for their own best interests and their own ways to reach their goals. And so you're going to have different ways to do so. So whether it's covering one piece of information and not covering another story, whether it's, you know, framing something in a certain light. So those are obviously journalistic ways to handle that. Or if it's on the other side and it's, you know, using freedom of information, but making them jump through hoops to get certain information. It's out there, but now we're going to make you jump through hoops to get to that. And so sometimes, you know, you have to use the tools, I guess, that are available. And so, you know, I think that it's put me in a perspective that I can, you know, it's no more than trying to, when I teach my classes, trying to really show your social scientists, and you need to be able to look at all of these situations from both perspectives, whether it's the media's perspective or, you know, the public side of it, or whether it's the Democrat side or the Republican side, you know. And I try to emphasize that in my classes, that you are here as social scientists, and that kind of allows them to look at more of a macro level to see both of those.
Now, we originally wanted to have this discussion because we heard from local folks about their different views on what happened in the U.S. Capitol January 6th. You know, we heard people saying Antifa were the drivers behind the January 6th insurrection, which was a narrative that was thoroughly, widely debunked by well-respected news organizations, including Reuters. But of course, the folks who still buy that narrative And we know that once a false narrative gets entrenched, it's very hard to take it out of consciousness or to convince somebody otherwise. But when did this skepticism over well-respected news organizations really begin?
I mean, realistically, what we saw on January 6th was the culmination of a four-year campaign of misinformation. You know, for years now, we've been hearing about the mainstream media and how we can't trust the media. We've been hearing these consistent talking points, this steady diet of you can't trust the mainstream media, this liberal media, they're out to get us, this fake news with alternative facts. And so, you know, it's almost a priming type of thing that when you have this steady diet of being told something for so long, that when a situation actually arises, you've been primed to think that. You've been primed to assume that it's something is being hidden from you, that we're living in this world, that there's all these conspiracies out there. And, you know, the mainstream media is just trying to hide things. They're only reporting on things that serve their purpose. But it's that steady diet of this misinformation that I don't think we realize the long-term consequences of.
And this is something that you've taken a close look, particularly at how the former president, Donald Trump, was using social media during his presidential during the first presidential campaign. And I'm going to get you to talk about that a little bit when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about news media literacy and the proliferation of fake news. UNCW Professor Jennifer Brubaker. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's National News Media Literacy Week, but we learned this after we decided to tackle an exploration of fake news and why more people seem to believe conspiracy theories and what we can do about the quality of our public conversations. In other words, divergent political views aside, if we're operating from completely different sets of facts, how do we arrive at the same table for a discussion? Professor Jennifer Brubaker of UNCW's Communication Studies Department is exploring the intersection of media and politics with us today. And Professor Brubaker, just before we went to break, you were talking about how people had been primed for 4 years to accept the notion that the election was stolen, that there was widespread fraud. But even before that started, before President Donald Trump's first term, you were actually looking at the role of social media in his candidacy. Can you talk about how he used that to, it was a strong component of his ability to get into the Oval Office in the first place?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you know, I mean, when Donald Trump campaigned for office, so starting, you know, 2015, when his campaign essentially began, you know, from the very beginning, he ran on this populist narrative. You know, everything he put out was this idea of populism, that it was us against them. It was me against everyone, that he was out to shake up the system. He was the outsider. He was coming in to drain the swamp, to, you know, establishing that he was this hero that was coming in to go ahead and fight against everything that was already out to get him and out to get his supporters. And so from the very beginning, it was very much framed. The campaign was framed through this lens of populism. And, you know, using his heavy use of social media, I mean, you figure he didn't run ads for, you know, how long in that first campaign, and he was so heavily reliant on social media. And it was this idea still of following along of, I'm different than your typical politician. I am the only one you can trust. I will tell you the truth. And, you know, and I think that his specific use of social media and his reaching out to his voters directly in his own voice tried to continue that and continue that I am the one you trust. And, you know, that falls in lines with the consistent talking points that we had over those 4 years, something that media is the enemy. You know, they are out to get us. You listen to me. I'm going to speak to you directly. I am going to tweet to you directly. And I am the only one you can trust. I mean, I know I still will see, even after everything that's happened, you know, since January 6th, I still just the other day saw someone share on social media how Donald Trump is the only person I still trust. And, you know, so it was establishing this idea of everyone else is bad and I am the only voice that you can believe. And so I think that social media gave him that platform to do that and to reach directly and to not have a role of a gatekeeper or any type of media filter out there, that it was just this unfettered kind of direct contact with voters.
Now, there seem to be differing opinions among researchers on whether one political side or part of the spectrum perpetuates or buys into falsehoods more than the other. Scripps says that both liberals and conservatives are prone to buying into garbage on social media. Then there was a 1964 study that gets widely cited that claims conservatives are more likely to fall for conspiracy theories. Then later research says that's not true. And then even later, other research says conservatives tend to lean into more paranoid thinking. And that conclusion, I don't know, to me, on the face of it, sounds biased on its own. So what do you make of this? Is there a group that's more likely to perpetuate and buy into some of these falsehoods?
I don't believe that either, you could say that either Democrats or Republicans are going to be the ones to buy into conspiracy more than another. I think that there are other conditions out there and other personality characteristics and such that would make people much more likely to buy into conspiracy theory than political affiliation. And I think that you're going to have a good majority of either Democrats or Republicans who are not going to buy into conspiracy. But of course, just like anything else, you're going to have your fringe groups that are going to be the ones. But I don't think it's necessarily directly related. Just because there might be a correlation in some point, I don't think that partisanship would be the cause of someone to buy into conspiracy theory.
So can you talk about the difference between news organizations that are legitimate news organizations, but have a slant, right, left, somewhere in the middle, and propaganda outlets that masquerade as news organizations, but really are not organizations operating according to basic journalistic principles? What's the difference?
You know, I mean, first of all, the first difference would be, I would have to say, within the looking just at news organizations. News organizations, yes, they may have a slant, but we also have to keep in mind that even within news organizations, there's a difference between news reporting and news analysis. And I think that that's the first component of this media literacy or news literacy that sometimes gets overlooked by people, that if they see it on a TV news channel, or if they read it from a news outlet, that it's news reporting. And all, you know, that's like reading, you know, going back, you know, 30 years and looking at a newspaper and reading the editorials and assuming that that's news reporting. But it's just not necessarily as clearly cut in TV or internet news. What is news reporting and what is news analysis? And so most news organizations, they, you know, it's the news analysis that has a slant, not necessarily the news reporting, not everything, but, you know, most mainstream news sources, it's the news analysis is where you're going to see some degree of slant. News reporting does tend to follow journalistic principles that, you know, journalists adhere to. And one of that is fair and balanced and, you know, good media coverage and, you know, covering the news stories. And then you have that analysis that, yes, might have the slant. So that's just within the news organizations. But now when you look more at these fringe outlets and what's the difference, now you run into the credibility and what that's all the standards of journalists, of journalism that good journalists try to adhere to, don't necessarily exist in those more fringe media outlets, whether it's looking for, you know, credibility of sources, you know, where are you getting this information from, checking for, you know, for different types of how actually credible are the sources that you are drawing from, whether it's gatekeeping, you know, is there a gatekeeping function? Are we just trying to get something out there quickly, or are we actually trying to get something out there accurately? And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, this is a problem that we've dealt with since the beginning of 24-hour news coverage of this, this expedience over quality or accuracy. And so those fringe outlets aren't necessarily doing any type of gatekeeping or credibility checking, and they're putting information out there. So you can't, there's different facets of this, whether it's even just within the mainstream media of analysis versus reporting, or now you're comparing mainstream media versus these more fringe kind of outlets.
And so these fringe outlets, as you call them, how can we tell that they're not actual journalistic organizations? Is there any good way to figure that out when they sound legit and they have microphones and cameras and they call themselves a news organization? I mean, are we starting to get into partisan politics a little bit here if we say this one is not legit, but this one on the other end of the political spectrum is? How do we figure out just what is fact-based?
It is so, so, so difficult. I mean, for people who actually do this, and this is, I mean, honestly, it's a good root of the problem. When you look at, you know, if we sit down, you and I, people who are in, you know, study this, do this on a daily basis, if we were to go through and say, what is really credible news, what are really credible news sources? And it would be very, very hard for us to do, let alone people who were relying on tweets and relying on headlines and just scrolling through their Facebook news feed to see things. It's just a very difficult challenge. Looking, usually a good way to do it is not necessarily even just to look at one source, but look at that topic and that article. Is this being covered other places? Is this something that is being, because, you know, traditionally, if you have a valid news story, it's not just going to be coming from one fringe outlet that I'm not really sure if that's something that's a credible source. Look and find where else this is coming from. Use that as a jumping off point and use it to conduct additional research. But then the problem becomes is that most people aren't really devoting that much time to something. It's just more, I mean, most people share news stories without having read the story. You know, it's oftentimes I read the headline and, or you read the headline and then you read the lead and then, okay, hit share. And so it's definitely looking for consistency of credibility and sourcing.
Now, there's a drum that I've been beating for a couple of years now that people are really tired of hearing about, but I'm going to ask you about it. How do we avoid throwing the baby out with the bathwater? And I mean, you're across the table from someone who has a completely divergent point of view. You might believe that their point of view comes from wildly fringe sources that are completely misinformed. Is there value in trying to understand that person? And is there a difference between understanding the person and understanding their opinion? Is it a waste of our time to try to understand some of these opposing points of view, even if you think that that view is based on propaganda and misinformation?
I think it's absolutely not a waste of time. I mean, if anything, it's those types of conversations in civil discourse that is going to help bridge some of this divide and help to try to fix some of this. I think a good jumping off point in conversations like that is, what makes you think that? You know, what got you to this point? Asking questions to help people understand. Explain it to me. Explain why you think that. Explain what has gotten you to believe this. And because people are automatically by nature going to get defensive if you come along and say, no, that's wrong. No, you're completely wrong. So that's going to shut down any type of constructive discourse that you could have with that person in order to kind of find a common ground. And a lot of times, it's not necessarily the whole of the person's belief system that's flawed. Sometimes it's just there's one perspective that they've gotten. And who knows, it could be because they watched a Facebook video or a YouTube video, or, you know, it's just a lie that they've seen so many times that even without realizing they're processing it, it's just, well, I just believe that. Well, but why do you believe that? Where did you find that? And so I think that it's only going to be hurtful if we just disregard an entire group of people based on the fact that we don't agree with some of the things that they say.
Can you talk about how easy it is to create images that appear credible? Photos, emails, even videos with the voice of someone saying something that perhaps they didn't actually say. That's much easier than it used to be.
Oh, it's incredibly, I mean, for people who are skilled at doing that, I mean, it's incredibly easy to create anything like that and make it seem that someone is saying something or doing something or pictured with someone. It's dangerous how easy that is for people who have those skills to do. I mean, even presenting, you know, I know before you mentioned about having, you know, a camera, but they have a camera, they have a mic, you know, we have a camera right here and we have a mic and, you know, my 13-year-old helped set it up, you know, and so anybody can do those types of things. And so it's not the environment that so many of us grew up in, where if it was on TV or it was a legitimate news source, now it could be anything out there. And so that is something you really have to always take with a grain of salt, that just because you see something, and that's really hard because, you know, that's always been our, well, if you see it with your own two eyes, then I know it's true. You know, a picture's worth a thousand words. Yes, you know, it's the stories that have video, it's the stories that have images. Those are the ones that really get the traction. And so it does become incredibly dangerous when those could be falsified.
And, you know, in the introduction, I cited an MIT study reported on in The Atlantic that finds fake news travels much more widely and deeply than actual news. And it also evokes much more emotion than the average tweet. And this MIT study was looking strictly at Twitter. But we know, for instance, that conspiracy theories are tempting to believe because they do evoke so much emotion in us, that flash of anger that makes us share it without really checking the story. But then, you know, I think of Flint, Michigan and the water contamination crisis there. And I think about, you know, the facts. It's so hard to believe that public officials conspired to save money instead of protecting the health of the very people they were charged with protecting. And this is exactly what the news media is for, to pull back the curtain on this stuff. So when you hear something that stretches credulity, like public officials poisoning the water in Flint, Michigan, in order to save money, what can you blame people for believing the worst?
Well, no. And that's, you know, when we hear things that are conspiracy ish, you know, when we hear those stories, first of all, they jump out to us because we have kind of a standard that we hold of just normalcy, just basic normalcy in stories. And then you hear something that's so outlandish that it just jumps out and we pay more attention to that because it's outside of the norm. And so it's, of course, it's going to garner more attention than something that's just an everyday type of story. And then when it's something that, like you mentioned, you know, evokes so much emotion in us, whatever that emotion is, now, again, that's going to make us pay more attention. That's going to cause us to want to share it. And then when you do bring up stories like Flint, Michigan, and you have something, that's basically all the reassurance that sometimes people need. See, look at what happened there. So that, but that doesn't mean that everything that you hear that sounds that kind of conspiracy-ish is actually true, just because in some instances it is true. Still, in the majority of instances, it isn't, but we do have to pay attention to it to some degree to keep from getting to other Flint, Michigan type stories. But that doesn't mean that just because one's true, they're all true.
Right, right. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, does our media consumption influence our political opinions, or is it our political opinions that drive our media consumption?
I think we have our political opinions to begin with. I mean, through basic political socialization process, you know, we are socialized from the time you're children to how you believe politically. And it's a process that continues throughout the entirety of your lives. You're never fully politically socialized. It's something that is impacted by all of the experiences that you have, your family members, your friends, your education, and the media. That's a huge influence in your political socialization, whether it's children who are watching cartoons where there's a person of color as the mayor of the town, or a woman, as you know, that they're being politically socialized at a very young age. But as adults, that doesn't mean that we stop being socialized by the things that we're seeing in the media. So it is one factor in making us who we are.
Right. You're listening to Coastline. UNCW Professor Jennifer Brubaker is my guest today. We're exploring news media literacy and why it might be harder than you think to tell a false story from a real one. After this short break, more on the red flags that could signal fake news. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. During National News Literacy Week, we're taking a closer look at the role of fake news in shaping our worldviews. We're looking at how we can be better news consumers and why social media is such a key part of the rise of propaganda. Dr. Jennifer Brubaker is an associate professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she specializes in the intersection of media and politics. In November, Lexington Books published her first book, Celebrity and the American Political Process. Professor Brubaker, you wrote a paper that examines the use of social media to promote one's political brand and connect with voters during congressional campaigns. And you analyzed 22 candidates for the U.S. House. What did you go ahead?
No, yes, we did. We just actually, I worked on that with some colleagues from the Department of PIA, who are all political science professors. And then I was the communication studies representative. And we did. We looked at congressional races in the 2020 campaign. I conducted brand analyses of 22 of, we studied 11 of the different, they were all open competitive races throughout the country. And most had at least one female candidate. And we studied to see what were their brands. First of all, there were different components of this study, but one of them was looking at their brands and how they were selling themselves to voters, essentially. And there was a very, very strong reflection of Donald Trump's brand that we saw throughout the congressional races that we studied, a very strong reflection of his populist narrative, of that hero narrative, of his style of tweeting, if they even down to whether it was the language he used and that they then reflected in their tweets, or even an all caps style, or calling for things like fraud in, you know, actually reflecting or parroting his sentiments that he was putting out there. And we saw a huge pattern that was the Republican candidates were the ones who were really reflecting this style. And most all, I think it was 10 out of the 11 races that we studied that the Republican candidates were really mimicking Donald Trump's style of communicating his brand to the public. So we're definitely seeing this as a trickle down into other campaigns, not just his.
And is there a partisan line there? Were these candidates all Republicans that were mimicking President Trump's style, or did they cross political lines?
No, it was all of the ones in the sample that we used. All of them were the Republican candidates that were mimicking Donald Trump's style, whether it was through aggression. A lot of it was through the aggressiveness of tweets and the specific language, the specific style. But it was definitely mimicking him, realistically reaching out to Trump supporters, trying to have that type of halo effect that if you like Donald Trump and you support Donald Trump, then by proxy, you should like me and you should support me. And so reaching out to those same voters.
So how does misinformation play into some of those campaigns? And I don't want to plant this strictly in the Republican camp, but how do we as news consumers or as voters find that line between actual misinformation versus partisan position?
Well, it's very hard, especially when it is a partisan issue, because you're going to naturally gravitate towards the things that are in line with your beliefs. And we have our trusted sources. And so I think that a big thing is making certain that your trusted sources are deserving of the trust that you're giving them. And, you know, no more than if it's, you know, it doesn't matter if it's political information or if you're reading COVID information, you know, the people and the sources that you can trust for that out there. And I think that a very important factor that people need to do is set up this network of people and media sources that they know they can trust and rely on those.
So how could we begin? And you've alluded to a couple of different ways that we can do that. But how can we begin to find media sources that are trustworthy? And is there a way for those folks who've already gone off to some of those fringe sources because they believe those are the only sources reporting the actual news, and that mainstream news media are co-conspirators in you know, some of this nefarious business? How do we build that list?
There are independent outlets out there. Looking in education and looking at research conglomerates at universities and such are oftentimes a good way to see what are they relying on? What are they looking at? What are these sources that you can kind of use? And seeing validation from one source to another, being able to learn to look at a news story and see who is being cited in this news story? What are the facts that are being included in this? And then the more that you do that, then you're setting up more of a network that you have that you can consistently rely on to know that you can trust.
So I have a question from an anonymous listener, and this says, what do I say to my dad when he says George Floyd didn't die of asphyxiation? He died of a drug overdose. And this gets to the social part of this and interpersonal relationships.
It really does. And I mean, that is, you know, that is something that we've seen so tragically, over the last number of years, is such divides in families, in interpersonal relationships, friendships, and such, when you do have people who are really buying into the fringe sources and are really buying into the conspiracy. And it's very hard. You know, you just want to say, what makes you think that? What have you heard that makes you believe that? Where are you getting that information from? And, you know, trying to, it's almost like, and there's been a lot of research out there that's compared it to almost like a cult mentality. And this, you know, this indoctrination like you would have into a cult of, you know, you can't just go when people are in a cult, you can't just go and pull them out and expect that they're all of a sudden going to feel differently or think differently. And so there's a lot of research that looks at the parallels between what we're seeing and being part of a cult. And it's very hard to try to talk people out of that. And so to say, how did you get to this? Where can you show me some of the sources that you have? Can you show me why this is being covered in this? Can you bring these news articles? Just slowly start. It's something that has to be a drawn out process. It's not something that you're going to have a debate and you're going to fix this at dinner. It's not something that's going to happen that way. And it has to be a, let's talk through the facts. Let's look through what you're seeing. Let's see what's out there. And the realization that you may not necessarily ever convince him of that. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that that's very hard to contend with when you feel like you have the truth on your side and you can't win somebody over. And so it might also be then, as you're moving into other issues and as they come up, just instead of letting it get to that point that it's at with him believing that about George Floyd, that possibly teaching how to, for future, because you may never convince him of that. But I think if you talk through where you're getting this information and the sourcing, that might help.
Yeah. And so we talked earlier about the difference between news analysis and actual news reporting, and how, you know, you can often identify news, legitimate journalistic organizations, as leaning left or right or being more moderate. I mean, they have a slant. Are there news organizations you would be willing to name that are certainly right or left leaning, but that are solidly journalistic, trustworthy news sources? Can you name some on both sides?
You really are. I would have to give that one some thought, because, you know, realistically, there's so much that you see that the journalism of it, there are still good journalists on both sides. And this idea that I don't think that anyone thinks anymore. And it is sad, because I know that when I'll teach in class and we'll talk about is the media biased, there's no one anymore who believes that the media is not. And that to me is kind of sad. But then realistically, when you look at the history of media, it was never intended to be. I mean, the history of media goes back to partisan press. I mean, it was only with the, you know, the creation of the Associated Press that that was purely for financial motives, that we came along and said, we're going to be objective. It was never intended to be objective, because journalists are people. And so they're going to come into something. But I do think that there's a lot of sources. Oh, I'm going to have to give that one some thought. That's to come up with specific sources. But that's, you know, they do exist, but you have to mainly just be able to decipher, is this someone's opinion, and where is the opinion versus where is the reporting?
So one of the examples of this, I've heard, you know, we've all heard some of the reporting about how Fox News, which most would identify as a right-leaning news organization. Some people say it's a credible news organization. Others say that it's not. Many of its former viewers have now migrated over to organizations like OAN, and Newsmax. And are those credible news organizations? And of course, this is only an example on the right, and there are multiple examples on the left that we could go into as well. But that's kind of the specifics of my question, I guess. Like,
I think,
you know, these pop up for different reasons.
Right. And I think that a credible news organization can really be identified by if you're reading through their stories or listening to their stories and you're seeing that there's some degree of balance and there's some degree of consistency amongst what they're writing about. You know, I think a big criticism with Fox News is oftentimes that they just leave out stories that they don't want to cover. And that is a red flag, in my opinion, of what makes a credible news organization is if everyone else, if, you know, if you're sitting there and you're looking at all of these major media outlets and they're all talking about something, and then you look at Fox News and they're not, that is a red flag that it's not a credible source of information if you're going to leave out a major story, a headline story, just because it doesn't align with your principles. So I think if you can look at a news organization and see that, yeah, they might have a conservative slant or they might have a liberal slant, but they are still giving proper attention to stories that might come in conflict with what you would deem to be a conservative perspective or a liberal perspective, then at least they're presenting it. If they're neglecting to cover it, that becomes a huge problem. So, you know, when you're trying to look at something that is credible, just see, are they only presenting stories that fall in line with their perspective? Because if that's so, that's propaganda. That's not news. But if they are presenting stories to you that they don't seem to necessarily benefit from a partisan point of view, then now all of a sudden, wait, we've got some news reporting going there. We've got some credibility.
Can you just give us an example? Because I'm sure a lot of our well-educated listeners who are engaged, responsible citizens don't think that they're ever guilty of perpetuating fake news. You know, that's something that people who maybe just aren't as aware do. Can you give us an example of how we might unwittingly do that and how we might twist a fact or an idea or theory to fit what we already believe?
You know, we hear things, you know, we mentioned before, we talked briefly about the idea of selectively exposing ourselves to information that's in line with our views. We also have the tendency to selectively perceive things the way that we want to perceive them. And so, you know, you have this with, for example, an election and someone taking office and coming along and only hearing the election promises that they want. And then when they hear them the way that they want to hear them. And so then when someone takes office, it's, well, why didn't that happen? Well, you didn't hear it the way that it was actually presented to you. You heard it the way that you wanted to hear it. And so we have a tendency to perceive things the way that will line up with our goals and our ambitions and what we want to come out of it. And so I think that that becomes something that people unknowingly do, that they are sharing something or believing a news story because it lines up with what they believe. And so they haven't, you know, or they at least read it like, oh, this is supporting my point of view, when in actuality, it might not be, or it might not be true, but they're sharing it because of that.
So how can we create a healthier news ecosystem? Maybe final thought.
A healthier news ecosystem. I think part of it comes from media literacy. I truly do. I think that understanding, but I think that we can't get too into believing that that's the answer to everything, because I think that so much of what our problem is more of a societal problem and an inability to see things from somebody else's perspective, an inability to realize that we're punctuating it seeing it from how we want to see it and how we believe to see it, or grouping entire groups of people by their partisanship and making an entire list of assumptions about people based on if they have an R or a D next to their name. And so some of it's societal.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Professor Brubaker, what a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful to chat with you.
Thanks also to Coastline producer Rachel Keith and technical director Ken Campbell, and special props to tech genius Kane Brubaker. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.